You're listening to The Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. As always, I'm your co-host, Ankit Panda, recording in Washington, D.C.
And I'm your other co-host, Katie Putz, also recording in Washington, D.C. How are you doing, Ankit?
Doing pretty good. It's a beautiful, beautiful fall day here in D.C. And as always, we got a lot to turn our attention to. So, Katie, I think we're overdue for a return to Central Asia on the show. And what better peg than the arrival earlier this month, in November, of 5 Central Asian presidents here in Washington, D.C., to mark not only the 10th anniversary of the so-called C5+1 format, which, you know, you wrote a bit about whether C5+1 is the right way to think about this these days, or 5C1+1s, as you put it in the headline for The Diplomat. But I think we could use this opportunity to, you know, not just take a look at what's happening in Central Asia, but think a little bit more about the very odd moment now in U.S. Central Asia relations and how the United States under the second Trump administration, as it's sort of rethinking various elements of U.S. foreign policy and strategy, is now thinking about Central Asia. So you were pretty close, you know, on the ground to the goings on during the C5+1. So why don't you maybe tell our listeners a little bit about what the big takeaways were for you from both the optics and the deliverables this time around?
Yeah, certainly. So, you know, I'm not going to go into the whole history of the C5+1. I've written about that. We did a whole video about that, which I can link in the notes on this. But the events that it was called a summit. I don't know if summit is actually the right word. This is maybe my hottest take of all of my Central Asia takes on this, because what happened was there was a business focused conference that was at an annex of the Kennedy Center. And then there was a working dinner at the White House. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to underemphasize how important this was for the Central Asian presidents. The 5 of them had never visited the White House together, let alone by themselves individually, other than Uzbek President Shavkat Mirziyoyev, who made a working visit to Washington in 2018. None of the other Central Asian presidents have ever gotten that. Now, this wasn't a state dinner. It didn't have all of the fanfare involved in that. What there was a very long table. It's actually, the optics were super interesting. It was a very long table. The Central Asian presidents were all on one side with their backs to the press. The Americans were all on the other side facing the press. And I was not in the room for that. They only had the White House press for that. But I, you know, watching that, the Central Asian presidents each gave brief remarks. And these were particularly, some of them were very interesting. The Kazakh president gave his remarks in English and told Donald Trump that he was sent from heaven to make peace on earth, I guess. And so there were remarks from everybody. And then I guess they had dinner. So I don't know if that's a summit. Going back to what some of the deliverables were. So this, the focus of the C5+1, and I wrote this in an article that you referenced, has really narrowed into the economic realm. Pretty much everything that was discussed, I mean, there was a business conference, were deals. Boeing is selling planes to more planes to Uzbekistan. They had announced a bunch of planes, 22 in September, and then an additional number were announced in this trip, but also Tajikistan and Kazakhstan. Kyrgyzstan had a deal with Coca-Cola. There was a bunch of other deals, particularly for Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, I think had the highest number, followed by Tajikistan, 1 or 2 for Kyrgyzstan, nothing for Turkmenistan. But those were the deliverables. There wasn't one joint statement after this. There were 5 bilateral sort of fact sheets. And then there were 2 statements of intent, one on economic integration or economic affairs, and the other one on cultural something, museum stuff. But it was very much narrower than past C5 events had been. It was at a higher level, which I think the pomp and circumstance really appealed to the Central Asian leaders of that. But I think on the other hand, it is thinner than it used to be in terms of interest. If you went back to the 2023 presidential summit, which was the first presidential summit of the C5+1's existence, Joe Biden met the 5 Central Asian presidents on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in 2023. And they released a comprehensive joint declaration that listed basically every aspect of relations. And that also included things like climate change, which are very important to Central Asian publics. And they should be important to Central Asian leaders, but they're not important to the United States. And they're entirely absent from all of the official stuff now. So I'll stop there and see what is most interesting to you. Sorry.
No, this is all interesting to me because I wasn't, following this as closely as I might because I was dealing with a lot of other things, let's just say, when this was happening in town. Coincidentally, I was at the hotel where some of the leaders were actually staying in downtown D.C. So I was, of course, exposed to some of the security details lounging around in the lobby, so on and so forth. But, a lot of what he said kind of tracks, I guess, with this mercantilist turn in American foreign policy, right? Like, if there's anything about how the Trump administration likes to do business, it is, extremely focused on mercantile ends and sort of resource extraction. So, talking about things like minerals and natural resources makes a lot of sense. And then, of course, a strong preference for doing business bilaterally, which I think is partly a function of just the loss of capacity within, the White House and the NSC in terms of the kinds of support you would need to actually prepare for a joint declaration versus, a bunch of kind of bilateral fact sheets, which is much more straightforward to put together. Mm-hmm. So from, I guess, that perspective, the outcomes here didn't really seem out of sync with what you might expect, knowing what we know about the Trump administration. Was there anything that sort of, you found to be sort of surprising or unexpected in terms of, what came out of this? Some of the stuff I think, you sort of alluded to in your article, at least, the cultural heritage components of some of the engagements here. Was that surprising, or what's the kind of behind the scenes there?
Yeah, that one was surprising to me, and I'm still trying to figure out why it exists. I think the reference I had made is that you could also look at that as a commercial thing. Tourism is a big growth sector for particularly Uzbekistan. And so some of those aspects are places where the United States can be of assistance, but are absolutely not controversial on either side. What I didn't mention in my long opening sort of screed was the critical minerals aspect. And that was the big headlines. A lot of the big headlines focused on deals and on critical minerals in particular. There's a U.S. company that is going to be exploring tungsten mining in Kazakhstan, a bunch of these other things. But this really it fits into the Trump administration sort of transactional preferences and that mercantilist tilt. But it also really fits into the Central Asian president's interest in sort of transactional diplomacy. They've always, I think, probably preferred this route. I had somebody ask me recently in regard to sort of the cuts in U.S. aid funding and that kind of thing, is anybody going to step into those roles in Central Asia? Is China going to fill these gaps and some of the softer stuff? And the answer in terms of Central Asia is that they're fine with nobody stepping into that gap. And so some of this, the gaps that I'm pointing out and the sort of setting aside of the honestly, the real difficult work of doing a big cooperative exercise like this, the Central Asians are fine with doing away with. And so there is interest on the Central Asian side in doing this sort of economic focused diplomacy. Trade and transport are really, really big topics in the Central Asia space right now. We could talk about the Middle Corridor. You can talk about oil and gas. You can talk about minerals. There's just a lot there. What I will be looking for is that a lot of these deals are Central Asian companies and Central Asian governments buying stuff from the United States. I'm interested to see how this plays out for the Central Asian governments. There was one headline that over the next 10 years, Uzbekistan is going to invest $100 billion in the United States. Uzbekistan's GDP is like $115 billion. So yes, spread over 10 years, that's a lot. That's, maybe doable, but that seems like an absurd figure to me. So I'm curious to see where the win is for Central Asia in that. I can see the win for the United States, but I'm curious about the long-term win.
I mean, they've learned something about Trump, right? I mean, there's always these ridiculous numbers thrown out. I think with the Japanese and the South Koreans, it's been like $500 billion, $300 billion. So, why not throw out $100 billion with the Uzbeks?
The Uzbek government and Central Asian governments don't have to sort of touch base with their publics in the same fashion that democratic states do.
Yeah.
So they can kind of make whatever deals that they want, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah. So the last question about this, and, you know, I do want to talk a little bit too about this annual consultative meeting between the Central Asian presidents before we close out. But I want to ask you one last thing about this, which is, I mean, this was a meeting that seemed like really devoid of kind of geopolitical competition with Russia and China, right? Like, I didn't really get a whiff on the U.S. side that anything that the Trump administration was sort of doing here with the five Central Asian leaders was about positioning the United States to kind of better compete in Central Asia. And, you know, like, we've talked for years and years on this podcast about just how realistic the United States should be about what is strategically possible in the region. But is that a correct reading on my behalf, or was there anything going on here that would suggest that the United States still views Central Asia as a, you know, battleground, so to speak, in terms of geopolitical competition with China?
Yeah, I mean, I think the U.S. does still view Central Asia as a bit of that battleground, but it doesn't have to be stated openly. I think, you know, I wasn't at the White House, but I was at the business conference. And so there were individual American speakers who, I think a couple of them might have mentioned China. You know, when you're talking about critical minerals, you're talking about China. And when you're talking about connectivity that is not through Russia, you're talking about Russia. And so it was present there. But I do think there was some care to the fact that the Central Asian governments don't want to talk about their relationship with China, with the United States. Central Asian governments, by and large, Kazakhstan really coined this term, but their foreign policies are what they like to call multi-vector foreign policies, which is a very clunky way of saying they will talk to anybody and deal with anybody on an individual basis. And so sometimes from an external perspective, it can look a little schizophrenic, and it can look like, yeah, you know, you're not picking sides. And it's like they're picking a side. It's the Central Asian side. That's the side they're picking.
Right.
And so, you know, that atmosphere is there when they're in Washington. That's what they talk about. You know, like I mentioned, Tokayev's remarks were just incredibly laudatory to Donald Trump. And then a week later, he was in Moscow, like signing an alliance with Vladimir Putin. And none of that is inconsistent with Kazakh foreign policy, even though from the outside it can feel a little, certainly from an American perspective, it can feel a little inconsistent. That stuff was there, but it was not like the top line, and it never would be. The Central Asian governments are not going to come out and condemn China or condemn Russia while standing in Washington. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. All right. So, Katie, before we close out the Central Asia conversation, let's jump a little bit ahead because it's been a busy month for Central Asian multilateralism, I guess, let's call it. So tell us a little bit about this annual consultative meeting that just took place, I guess, a few days before or just as we are stepping in today to record. What are the latest takeaways from what's happening in the region? Anything catch your eye there?
Yeah. So the Central Asian presidents, I think they started in 2018, meet annually with just the five of them. And that was kind of novel. It was honestly very novel because previous to that, those five Central Asian presidents, they were together at many, many things. But Russia was always in the room, or China was always in the room, or it was at the UN. They never really sat down together. And so the sort of advent of these, they call them, they don't call them leaders meetings. They call them consultative meetings, which is a mouthful. But they've been doing them roughly annually since 2018. This year's, they announced that they would be formally welcoming Azerbaijan as a member of that group, which is, I think, part of this trade and transit focus. To make the Middle Corridor work, you have to cross the Caspian Sea and you have to sort of start going through the Caucasus. And so involving Azerbaijan is logical on that sense. I think on another sense, it might kind of dilute a little bit of the innovation and the benefit of the Central Asian group. The other thing of note is the Uzbek president, what's the word that he used? He used the phrase Central Asian communities. So there has been this push on the Uzbek part towards greater cooperation with the region. They're very careful not to use the word integration or to hint at any kind of political entity. Everything is very heavily economic focused, but the idea of having some kind of Central Asian community. Now, there's a lot of complexities in that. So whether there would be some kind of Central Asian community on an economic level and whether it would grow into something larger is unknown. But it is interesting that that is starting to come out more publicly. I think the other Central Asian governments have their own perspectives on this. Certainly Turkmenistan is less interested. I think Tajikistan is a little less interested, but we shall see where that goes.
All right. Absolutely. No, that's a very helpful update. I wasn't tracking that at all. So really interesting to get your views on all that. So I think we'll end it here for today, Katie. And before we do that, I want to thank all of our listeners, of course, for listening to the podcast. And remember, we are now on YouTube, so you can also watch us speak if you're interested in consuming your podcast content that way. But as always, don't forget to leave us a review. You can do that anywhere you get your shows, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple, whatever works for you. And don't forget to leave us a review as well. We really do appreciate that feedback, and it helps the show grow. So thanks a lot for listening. And Katie and I will be back soon with a lot more on the Asia Geopolitics podcast.